The Teaching of the Master by Brother L.G. Sargent. Part 3, Chapter 3, The Law of the Heart, Matthew 5, verse 21-24. Ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. And whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of the Gehenna of fire. If therefore thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Jesus does not interpret the law in general or in abstract terms. He quotes excerpts from the law as commonly understood, and against these he puts in contrast the true righteousness illustrated by examples from daily life. Penetrating as these are, they are illustrations only. At no point do they define the limit of what is required of a disciple. They're not always stated in a strictly literal form, and they are given with the entire absence of qualification, which is the mark of Oriental speech. They are designed to work through the imagination so as to create a certain disposition of mind and mould of character. The formula, ye have heard, is a traditional scribal phrase with a sense of you have understood this to mean. It was said is a customary form which reverently avoids naming God as the speaker. To them of old time is a reference to the contemporaries of the giving of the law on Sinai. But the effect of the whole formula is to contrast what he says with scribal tradition rather than with the written law. Filtered through the mouths of scribes, the law had been made burdensome and remote. But when he said, I say unto you, the word was brought very nigh unto them, so that it might be in their mouths and in their hearts that they might do it. Because every saying of Jesus leads back to the springs of action in the heart, it is his principle that the disposition to do wrong is equivalent to the act. A deed which a man would do if he dared is a deed done but for the chance to do it. And so it is reckoned in the judgment of God as though it had been committed. Elementary as this may seem to us, it did not seem so to the Pharisee Josephus, who says, the purposing to do a thing, but not actually doing it, is not worthy of punishment. His context precludes the possibility that he was thinking merely of human judgment, and the remark is a sidelight on the Pharisaic mind. But Jesus takes us still further back. Murder begins not with the thought of murder, but with the thought of uncharitableness. From that germ it may grow through contempt to anger, and from anger to hatred, until desire to be rid of the enemy burns like a red flame in the mind. The law said, Thou shalt not kill. And by way of summary, Jesus adds, Whosoever killeth shall be in danger of the judgment. For the law said, He that smiteth a man so that he die shall surely be put to death. Three forms of offence are paralleled with three degrees of judgment. Anger unexpressed renders a man liable to the local court. The contemptuous word, empty head, makes him liable to the Sanhedrin. And abuse of a man's moral character makes him liable to the most disgraceful form of capital punishment when the body is thrown out to be burned, a parable of divine rejection. The margin of the Revised Version makes "thou fool" stand for the Hebrew moreh, which is used of the rebellious son in Deuteronomy 21, verse 18 and verse 20. It means the folly of stubbornness in rebellion against God's law. Many commentators concur, and in this case the Greek moreh would be a transliteration as with Rakah. It might, however, be a translation for Nebal, the word which only too aptly gives a name to the churlish husband of Abigail. It seems in any case to carry a suggestion of moral perversity. No tribunal can judge unspoken anger, and no judiciary would enforce the death penalty for a word. The language belongs to the realm of parable. But how impressive is the picture of the city elders in conclave to determine whether a black look had the germ of murder in it, or the whole Sanhedrin weighing whether a word of contempt was meant to stab like a sword. How solemn the portrayal of the utter rejection of a man who had used defamatory language. Here in the first of Jesus' applications of his law to life, we are confronted with his habit of speaking in pictures. A single phrase can, on his lips, have the vividness and compactness of a cartoon. The lesson on his method, which the example gives, is to be borne in mind as the rest of the sermon is studied. Even if "without cause" is an interpolation, it is not the use of the words in themselves which is contemned, for Jesus uses the very same term of the Pharisees in their blindness. It even occurs in the sermon applied to the man who builds on sand. It is the angry mind which comes under judgment, and Jesus assumes that the anger is of a kind which betrays the absence of love, and therefore, however incipiently, the presence of hate. There may be a righteous anger consistent with love, but whether it is so may be determined by one test. However stern its expression, it will aim at restoring the sinner instead of repelling him by one's own self-righteousness. But for Jesus, there is no neutral state. The absence of love is hate, and hate is murder in embryo. He goes beyond the law, "Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart," and lays bare the sources from which the bitter spring can flow. To treat such sayings as these with prosaic literalism is to limit their scope and thus defeat their aim. What Jesus is doing is, by a series of verbal pictures, to give a portrait of that invisible heart of man which is betrayed by the bitter and hasty word. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Perhaps Jesus' extension of the meaning of the verb to kill is in the mind of James in a singular passage where it can scarcely be taken literally, for it would mean that murder was a not infrequent practice in the early church. "Ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain, ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not." All the way through the third chapter, James' mind is leavened with the words of Jesus, though he reproduces the thought without direct quotation. The association with Matthew 5, verse 22 is evident when he says of the tongue, "Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men which are made after the image of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing." It is from his conclusion that the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace, that James turns at once to its opposite. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lusts, literally, pleasures, that war in your members? And so to verse 2. Ye kill and desire to have. It is murder in the heart, the product of the bitter stream from the poisoned spring. One section of the law which has a particular bearing on the Lord's teaching is that which concerns malicious perjury. A man who has given false witness with the object of getting an innocent man convicted is himself to suffer the penalty which he might have brought on the other. Then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand. As at least two witnesses would be needed to establish a charge, such a case would involve a conspiracy to commit perjury. If their testimony was accepted in a case for which the penalty was death, and the sentence was carried out, then they would be guilty of what might be called constructive murder. If the perjury was discovered, then the intention to bring about a death is treated as murder, and the perjurer loses his own life. The case is not quite parallel with the words of Jesus, because perjury is an overt act on which a court could judge the issue of fact. But it is the one case in the law in which the penalty is imposed for what he had thought to do, for the intention rather than for the deed. And it establishes the principle that even under the law, a man could be held culpable before God for what was in his heart. To enter into the kingdom will be to come into the presence of God. And this will only be possible for those who draw near before God in the days of mortality. In verse 23, Jesus accepts without question the means of approach appointed for that age, the coming to the altar and the ritual of sacrifice. But from the days of Cain and Abel, whether sacrifice was acceptable depended on the frame of mind in which it was brought. Sacrifice is worthless unless it is an act of faith. Hence the demand for obedience in observing the form of offering God prescribes. To offer to God a gift of one's own choice in a way of one's own devising is a failure to acknowledge God's majesty. It is therefore not faith but presumption, not submission to God but the assertion of self. It is to make God secondary to our own feelings about him, and therefore less real than ourselves. Without faith it is morally impossible to obey the command to worship the Lord our God and serve him alone. This principle Jesus carries into a new field. Faith in God is faith in the character of God, who is love. And this faith, unless it animates the worshipper's own life, is dead. Worship in spirit and in truth means that the worshipper is becoming progressively more like the object of his devotion, and without reflection of God's mind, the worship is neither true nor spiritual. The condition which makes worship acceptable is to be found in a man's attitude not only to God, but to men. Only the pure in heart shall see God, and there can be no drawing near with murder in the heart. The sacrifice of the wicked is abomination. How much more when he bringeth it with a wicked mind? Proverbs 21, verse 27. For this reason, verses 23 to 24 arise as a conclusion from the preceding verse linked by if, therefore. A man has come to the temple with his offering, has passed through the court of the Gentiles and the court of the women, up the steps and through the splendid Nicanor gate into the court of the Israelites. The lamb has been found without blemish and accepted. It is slain and is about to be cut up to be laid on the altar of burnt offering, when there is a surprising interruption. The worshipper asks that it may be left until he has gone on an errand and returns. We can imagine the astonished looks of the priests. Only religious duty, and that of the most pressing kind, could justify such an unconventional course. Has the offerer omitted some ritual requirement? The Talmud says, if a man is on the point of offering the Passover, and remembers that there is any leaven left in his house, let him return to the house and remove it, and then come to finish his Passover. But Jesus applies this principle to the leaven of malice and wickedness. The man has at the last moment remembered a grievance, not which he has against someone else, but which someone else has against him. It must be removed before he can be in communion with God. Far better, of course, to remember sooner and not to disturb the orderly service of the temple. But Jesus, in his vivid way, has pictured the extreme example so as to impress the lesson. Let a man examine himself, and so let him eat. That he does not eat and drink, judgment unto himself. One more example, which follows under this general heading of the Lord of Murder, opens up a wide view of man's standing before God. The Teaching of the Master, Part 3, Chapter 4, Judgment and Mercy. Matthew chapter 5, verse 25 and 26. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. A man owes a long-standing debt. His creditor decides to sue for recovery and comes to the house to demand the debtor's attendance at the court. As they go together, there is still a chance to compound with the creditor, who can then have the case withdrawn from hearing. But pride and self-interest to combine to suggest a more cunning way. There is some past transaction which can be made the subject of a counterclaim. The debtor thinks, if you take the law you shall have. Perhaps it can be made to serve my ends as well as yours. And so he comes before the judge acting his part. As the plaintiff's case is unfolded, the defendant's expression and gestures portray pain, surprise, indignation, and resignation at the perversity with which the righteous are afflicted. His defence is presented with fervour and ingenuity, and with protestations of the justice of his cause, and he waits with an air of triumph to hear the decision. But it is not the first time that the judge has heard a counterclaim, which would never have been thought of but for the bringing of the claim. The counterclaim is dismissed, judgment is given for the full amount of the claim, and as the defendant cannot pay, he is committed to prison. Some such picture is called up with a touch of ironic humour by the Lord's words. On the obvious level, it was a rebuke to the litigiousness which is almost a part of daily life in the East. How futile is this attempt to assert your own rights and gain your own ends? So Jesus was saying, in effect. And how loveless! What a violation of the essence of the law! But some words in James' letter may lead us to see a deeper meaning. For when James says, mercy rejoiceth against judgment, He is stating the obverse side of the picture of judgment without mercy, which is the climax of this parable. As one sees more and more reflections of the Lord's words in his epistle, it becomes a growing conviction that James is consciously alluding to this passage. The situation he describes is different, but it must be borne in mind that as Jesus uses the word, mercy is not the prerogative of the plaintiff. The defendant may show the same spirit in his readiness to come to an agreement. James says that those who show favour to the well-dressed man and despise the poor are become judges with evil thoughts, and their fault is not only in being bad judges, but in being judges at all, for he has in mind Matthew 7 verse 1. By constituting themselves judges of men, they too come under judgment by a law which knows no mercy. For under it transgression in one point is a breach of the whole. Sin being lawlessness, he who stumbles in one command is guilty of all. But there is another law which James calls the law of liberty, the perfect law, into which a man may gaze so that he continues in it as a doer of the work, and is blessed in his doing. This is a paradoxical phrase, like speaking of the restraint of freedom, or the control of uncontrol. James has spoken of it as the royal law, and J. F. MacFadyen paraphrases, God's law is an imperial law, meant for freedom and not for slaves. This is the law of the merciful man, whose love for his neighbour is not limited to the narrow channel of specific commands, but spreads over life with the completeness of the natural love for oneself. The man who, living in this law, reflects the qualities of his heavenly Father, will be judged with the mercy which he himself gives. So speak ye and so do, says James, as men that are to be judged by a law of liberty. Under that law alone, mercy may glory against judgment. It belongs to those who are merciful because they know their need of mercy. This carries our vision up to a higher court than any which judges debts between men. And in making this story of the self-righteous defendant a parable of divine judgment, Jesus was speaking in a way not outside the grasp of contemporary thought. Something of the parabolic framework is contained in one of the sayings of the fathers. They that are born are destined to die, and the dead to be brought to life again, and the living to be judged, to know that he is God, he the discerner, he the judge, he the witness, he the complainant. Moreover, the words, whilst thou art with him in the way, contain an echo of the Septuagint of Isaiah 55 verse 6, seek ye the Lord, and when ye find him, call upon him. And when he shall draw nigh to you, let the ungodly leave his ways, and let him return unto the Lord, and he shall find mercy. The word for adversary is antidikos, which has the meaning of complainant or opponent in legal proceedings. In the light of these facts, we might freely paraphrase the thought of the Lord's parable as follows. If you think to get the advantage by taking your stand on the law, then by the law you must be judged. But that is a two-edged weapon. You will find yourself involved in a lawsuit to which there can be only one issue. You will be indicted by God's righteousness in the court of God's justice, and the arm of God's law will carry out the sentence. It will mean imprisonment until the debt is discharged, and that will be forever. For the prison is the grave, and the debt is your life. And for that no redemption can be paid, nor can any man pay a ransom for his brother. And we might add, as being implied in the parable, but if yours is the spirit of mercy, then he who was your adversary becomes your advocate. For if we have an advocate with the Father, it is God himself who has provided Jesus Christ the righteous for that purpose. The object of this parable, then, is to show that the Lord of Murder enshrines a principle which, having first been used to search the inmost motives of man to man, is next extended to cover all the conflicts of life. But in so doing, it relates a man's attitude to other men to the fact that he himself stands under judgment. And if the footing on which he stands before God is purely legal, judgment must be synonymous with condemnation. And so the exposition of the law has kept in view the problem confronting the reader in verse 20. What is righteousness? With what can a man stand before God and enter into his kingdom? Not with a legal righteousness for all our debtors. The theme is the same as that which is treated from another angle in the parable of the unmerciful servant. This implied contrast between legal righteousness and the righteousness of faith, which, though the terms are not used, is at the root of the teaching of Jesus, is maintained by James. He distinguishes between the royal law, the law of liberty, on the one hand, and the law which condemns, which we might by antithesis call the law of bondage, on the other. The principle of this law is a living faith made manifest in works of love. And it is this which James is expounding all through his epistle. The final contrast with the law of works is found in his last word. He that converteth a sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. Law reveals sins and brings death. Love covers sins through bringing the sinner to find forgiveness. And so, though in perfect consistency with the righteousness of God, love brings a triumph over judgment. The law which triumphs in saving life is the law of love and liberty, and in that we find the essence of that grace and truth which James derived from him who is the glory. It is a law of liberty because it has its root in the truth which makes free, and so is a law for free men. It stands in contrast to that yoke which, said Peter in James' presence, neither we nor our fathers could bear. Even apart from the elaborations of rabbinical tradition, the law of Moses is through the weakness of the flesh a ministration of death, a bond written in ordinances which was contrary to us. There was not and could not be a law given which could have given life. The law of liberty, on the other hand, is a ministration of the Spirit. It is Paul who gives one of the most beautiful illustrations of the principle in which, as a follower of Christ, he becomes in some sense a type and figure of the Saviour. Writing on behalf of the converted Onesimus, he makes himself responsible for the money which the slave had stolen from Philemon. If he hath wronged thee or oweth thee aught, put that on mine account. I, Paul, have written it with mine own hand. I will repay it. Albeit I do not say to thee how thou owest unto me, even thine own self besides. The master of the runaway was not unmerciful, and doubtless he would recognize his greater debt, not only to Paul, who saved him with the word of life, but to the Lord that bought him. at the root of the thought of both James and Paul is to be found the same contrast between bondage and freedom, judgment and mercy, law and life. And however rich the diversity in their development of the thought, fundamentally they are at one. James, as truly as Paul, is opposing legalism with grace. They are at one because they start from the same point in the teaching of the glory, who is Lord to them both. Their common ground is that the idea of a legal basis for life before God has been demolished forever by him who came to fulfill the law.
Thank you.